Hello and welcome to this very special podcast in which I'm going to be speaking to Ross Beaver and Jenna Lucas about the issue of set aside, and in particular the recent decision of the Court of Appeal in the case of Goddard Watts and Goddard Watts, in which the Court of Appeal considered the correct approach to financial claims once earlier orders have been set aside, and the correctness of what's called the Kingdon approach. More on that later. Ros is a partner in Irwin Mitchell's London and Manchester offices and national head of Irwin Mitchell's divorce and family team. She's acted in a number of landmark and high-profile cases, and very excitedly for this podcast, she even acted in Sharland and Gohill and Goddard Watts itself. And Jenna is a recent addition and new star at Pump Court Chambers, specialising in financial remedies and children cases, for which she's repeatedly praised in the directories. Jenna was a former partner at Irwin Mitchell, where she worked alongside Ros on a number of these set-aside cases herself. So who better to have to come and speak to me today? Jenna, Ros, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tara.
Thank you, Tara, for having us on the podcast. I, for one, am delighted to be here talking about what is, I have no shame in saying, one of my favourite topics.
Oh, well, Jenna, that is lovely. And particularly because I know you are interrupting your half-term holiday. So we're really grateful. So, Jenna, if I can start with you, what do we mean when we're talking about set-aside applications?
On a very basic level, Tara, by set-aside, we mean when the court rescinds or varies an order that's previously been made by the court. In the context of what we're discussing today, that's an order or judgment that is a financial remedy. And it doesn't have to mean the whole judgment or order, it can mean only part of it. And it doesn't matter how that order has been made, whether it followed a contested hearing and a decision imposed by a judge, or whether that was a consent order application dealt with on paper. And it's an application really to set aside only where no error of the court is alleged, because obviously if you're alleging an error of the court, then you're in the realms of a Part 30 application, applications for permission to appeal, and that process is quite different. So it's important that that distinction is drawn.
And so what are the particular situations in which you might be able to persuade a court to set aside an order? What are the grounds?
Well, the grounds on which an order will be set aside, the practice direction says is a matter of judicial discretion, but it lists certain circumstances, including fraud, probably the one that most people think of, or material non-disclosure, mistake, but only limited types of mistakes, or subsequent events which were unforeseen and unforeseeable at the time that the order was originally made, which invalidates the fundamental basis on which that order has been made by the court. And I will interject here to say, Tara, in the sphere of arbitration, which obviously is something we're all doing a lot more of now, it's unnecessary to invoke the set-aside procedure if the order has not yet been made. The upshot of the judgment in Haley and Haley, which we'll all be familiar with, is that if the arbitrator's award is challenged on the basis of what normally would be an application for set aside, the yes. application that at that point is by way of Form A.
Okay. You spoke about it being within judicial discretion, and you've given us examples. Are they the kind of closed and fixed grounds, or do you think it's possible to argue that there are more grounds?
Well, I think the law in this area is actually quite unsettled. It's been unsuccessfully argued that the court has an almost unfettered discretion to set aside orders where exceptional circumstances exist.
Mr. Justice Mostyn disavowed us of that suggestion quite firmly in the way that only Mr. Justice Mostyn can in the case of CB and EB in 2020. He considered the circumstances in which financial orders could be discharged both under Section 31, the Matrimonial and Family Proceedings Act of 1984, and the common law.
And he considered that the circumstances which the common law had established a review of a financial order might be triggered as being, if there's been fraud or mistake, there's been material non-disclosure, if there's been a new event since the making of the order, which invalidates the fundamental basis on which the order was made, and then identified if the order remains executory, known to most family lawyers as the Thwaite jurisdiction. So, Tara, it can be said that there are two main headings for setting an order aside. The first being an erroneous basis of fact, say the misrepresentation, material non-disclosure or fraud, or the second being an unforeseen supervening event after the order, which invalidates the fundamental assumptions on which the order is made. It's interesting in my view that Mr. Justice Mostyn disagreed with Mrs. Justice Knowles when she'd expressed in Akhmadova and Akhmadova number 6 in 2020 that the categories are not closed or limited to those identified in the practice direction. Mr. Justice Mostyn is clearly of the view that the grounds are to be read literally and interpreted strictly. And I think that might well be an issue which will be the subject of higher consideration at some point in the future.
And so can you give me any example of factors or grounds that might have been argued which don't suffice?
I think the most obvious one really, Tara, is bad or negligent legal advice. That was considered by Mr. Justice Mombi in 2008 in a case of L&L, where the husband had claimed, amongst other things, to have been badly advised by his solicitor. And Mr. Justice Mombi in that case conducted a thorough analysis of all of the authorities and determined that the husband could not rely on it in support of his application to vary periodical payments. But he could rely on it in support of his application to vary periodical payments, but beyond that could not rely upon any allegation that he was led into a consent order by bad legal advice in seeking to set aside the order, and the authorities barred him for doing so.
Okay. And so, Ros, can I turn to you now? First of all, what are the key decisions on set aside? And secondly, how many have you acted in?
Well, first of all, thanks, Tara. The main decisions, the Supreme Court decisions, are Sharland and Gohill, both of which I was fortunate enough to act in. There's another Supreme Court decision, Takar and Gracefield Developments. And whilst that's not a matrimonial case, it applies with equal force and has been cited with approval by family judges. So we're really lucky that we've got three Supreme Court cases to look at and to guide us. So although the other cases, I suppose, that we should touch on and are relevant, focusing not necessarily on fraudulent non-disclosure, is of course the 1985 House of Lords decision in Libsey and Jenkins, which was not fraudulent. In that case, the wife had not disclosed that she was getting married again because she didn't know she had to do so. So there's that case. There's also Kingdon, which we'll be talking about, I'm sure, later as part of our discussion. And more recently, we've got Goddard Watts, which I was very lucky to be involved in that case as well. And very, very recently, Fawn and Cummings, I suppose, is another one that might get a mention.
And so just focusing on Sharland and Gohill, if I may, can you just tell us in a nutshell what the Supreme Court decided?
I think in a nutshell, there were two issues which were central to the case, to both cases. One was the burden of proof and one was materiality. So looking, I think, first at the burden of proof, ordinarily, the burden of proving that an order should be set aside would lie with the applicant, the person wanting to set aside the order, and to prove that proper disclosure would have resulted in a different order being made. In the case of an order made by consent, which is the position with Sharland, Gohill and Goddard Watts, the fraudster would need to prove that the fraud wouldn't have induced a reasonable person to enter into it. And it's looking at those specific terms at the time. So all consent orders made, which were subsequently set aside, all of those consent orders were subsequently set aside, albeit that they had different nuances. So those particular orders were consent orders, and we looking at the burden of proof. In the case of deliberate or fraudulent non-disclosure, that burden of proof shifts and it's for the non-disclosure to satisfy the court that its existence would not have led to a different order being made, or might not have led to a different order being made. So, I mean, I think what we've got to take away from it, fraud's obviously a serious allegation to make. And when you assert that, someone has it intentionally or fraudulently misled the court into making an order. What came out of Sharland, and Lady Hale said it very, very eloquently, is that once fraud has been proved by the applicant, the burden rests with the respondent, i.e. the fraudster, to satisfy the court. And that distinction was made. In the case of an order made following a trial, had the court known the information that's come to light at the time the trial was ongoing, might it have made a different order? So those are the key elements alongside materiality. Interestingly, in 2021, in Cathcart and Owens, Mr. Justice Mostyn gave the issue some additional considerable thought and seems to be of the view that once fraud's been proved, the burden of proof should be on the applicant. But of course, he's going to have to go some way to trump the Supreme Court decisions. I think it's important probably to just touch on Ladder Marshall, because Ladder Marshall provides a short test which a party wishing to adduce fresh evidence on appeal must satisfy. Firstly, the evidence couldn't have been obtained by reasonable diligence during the trial. Secondly, the evidence is such that if given, it would probably have an important influence on the outcome of the case, although it doesn't have to be decisive. And thirdly, the evidence is credible, although it doesn't have to be undeniable or, in the word used in the judgment, incontrovertible. And Lord Wilson made it clear in Sharland that these principles don't apply in cases of non-disclosure, rightly, in my opinion. Lord Wilson essentially said that it can't be fair that an applicant alleging fraud discovered post-trial or post-final order has been made should have to satisfy the Ladder Marshall test. Rationale being Ladder Marshall shouldn't be prevent the appellant from seeking a further opportunity to adduce fresh evidence following an earlier trial. And it's distinguishable from someone discovering something of which the applicant knew nothing because of deliberate concealment when an order was made. So in circumstances where it was genuinely the case that the information was available for the first time. So building on that, in Takkar and Gracefield, the Supreme Court added that even if an allegation of fraud is not raised at first instance, an application to set aside on grounds of fraud can still be made, even if the evidence could have been obtained by reasonable diligence. And this was confirmed in the Court of Appeal decision in Park and CNH. And more recently, Mr. Justice Mostyn dealt with it in the High Court in Fawn and Cummings.
Because I was going to say, not everyone who non-discloses does so with an intention to defraud or conceal. Somebody might discover, for instance, post an order, whether consent or after trial, that they're suddenly a beneficiary of a substantial family trust and they just didn't really realise. So how does the court distinguish in its treatment between the intentional non-disclosure and perhaps a more hapless litigant?
The innocent discovery of an interest in a family trust or any other sort of financial resource, it could be a bank account, a post office account, still has the potential to be relevant or material non-disclosure. And here the test is materiality of the non-disclosure rather than the intention behind it. So a victim of innocent non-disclosure must satisfy the court that had the information or evidence been disclosed, it would have made a material difference to the decision, whereas the bar seems to be lower in cases of fraudulent non-disclosure, where the innocent party must satisfy the court that it might have made a difference. So, for example, putting it differently, if you had a forgotten post office account with £100 in it, it probably wouldn't persuade a court to interfere, even though it should have been disclosed, in which case there was non-disclosure, but it wasn't material non-disclosure. Yeah. Where the line's drawn will depend on the circumstances of the case. And of course, in the first round of Goddard-Watts, it was found that the husband's interest in a family trust was very much within his knowledge at the time of the consent order in 2010. It was sufficiently material to impeach the fairness of the consent order. But hypothetically, had Mr. Goddard-Watts satisfied the court that he'd not known of his interest, would it have changed things? Probably not, because of the extent of the non-disclosure. And it was always going to be material given the value of the non-disclosed assets.
Okay, well, we're going to speak about Goddard-Watts in a little bit more detail in a moment. But before we get to that, Jenna, can you just tell me what happens once a court has been persuaded to set aside an order? How does the court then approach determining what the correct order should be?
Ultimately, Tara, the court has a really wide discretion to determine how to proceed after an order has been set aside. The court can start the inquisitorial inquiry completely afresh, a full root and branch reassessment of the application, looking at matters as they stand today, or it can adopt a more targeted approach and build on the order which the court has already made, dealing only with the distribution of the undisclosed assets. That is, in the shortest form of description, the kingdom approach, when the court siphons off those assets and deals with it at that point. And the kingdom approach has really gained some family law notoriety following the quite recent appeal in Goddard-Watts. I doubt many of us would have referred to it as thus a few months ago. So in some cases, it's entirely appropriate and open to the court to deal only with the undisclosed assets and give the innocent party a top up to the existing provision that's been made. And in many cases, Tara, that's likely to be a cost and time proportionate way forward. In Kingdon and Kingdon, which is a 2010 case, the judge held that the husband's non-disclosure of assets, specifically, he purchased shares for £200,000 just 3 weeks before he swore his Form E. That's a blast from the past for those of us who remember when Forms E used to be sworn as an affidavit. And that was just that was before a consent order was made in financial remedy proceedings. And it was considered it was deliberate material and vitiated the final order, which had been made by the court, actually made by consent at the door of the court of a final hearing. It transpired that the husband in that case had sold the shares, making a profit of about 1.26 million, 18 months after the order had been made, and the wife found out about it around 2 years later. The husband in that case had exacerbated his non-disclosure by then lying about it when the wife's solicitors made inquiries of him, and the judge determined in that case that it was unnecessary and inappropriate to set aside the whole of the order and direct a full rehearing of the wife's application. Instead, the wife was awarded an additional lump sum, a top up, if you like, of 481,000 to represent her interest in those non-disclosed assets. And the husband appealed that decision to the Court of Appeal, which considered the important question in the appeal to be, when the court finds that an order for ancillary relief, as it was then called, was vitiated by non-disclosure, should it set it all aside and direct the application for ancillary relief be entirely reheared on a later date on the basis of a conventional examination of all of the up-to-date figures and other circumstances? Or can the court, and if so, when, proceed and make the additional or different provision, which in its view would have been made at the time of the order in the event that proper disclosure had been given? And the Court of Appeal dismissed the husband's appeal about the way that the judge had dealt with the non-disclosure by going ahead and making an order almost in isolation, and said that the judge had been entirely entitled to deal with the case in the way that he had, by building on the existing order and making the additional provision for the wife, which in the judge at first instance view would have been made had the husband given the proper disclosure in the first instance. And the husband had argued in that case, ironically, for rehearing because it seemed there'd been a downturn in his own financial circumstances since the order was made. He said that the court needed to look effectively at the case again and at all of the circumstances as they stood now. But the Court of Appeal said that it was open to the court simply to remedy the defect by the non-disclosure because A, the court had discretion how to deal with the issue. B, the court was required to deal with the case justly and proportionately to the issues. C, the non-disclosure was discreet and could be cured by a simple enlargement, applying the same sharing principle that the parties had adopted to their consent order. D, the fact that the order had been fully implemented and didn't need to be unpicked. And also the court said that the husband's lies, exacerbated by his lies on the wife's inquiry when she got wind of the shares, meant that the husband's financial circumstances then would not be accepted by the wife and would otherwise have required a wholesale re-examination. And the approach of the court to this issue needed to reflect the degree of the husband's turpitude in that case. Mm. So in summary, Tara, the court's got a really wide discretion as to whether they start the process again or whether they deal with the non-disclosure and build on the existing order.
But what's really striking about Kingdon is that the sort of building block approach is being used really to protect the wife from any further erosion because of the husband's change of circumstance, rather than being applied in a restrictive way, which might have been thought to be unfair to the wife given the circumstances of the non-disclosure.
Absolutely, and I think the fraudulent non-disclosure or the person who misrepresents their assets can expect to see the court adopt the process to suit the person who is the victim of the non-disclosure. And so the roles were really reversed in Kingdon versus the positions adopted by the parties in Goddard Watts, where it was the husband looking for a wholesale re-examination. But really, I think you can expect, as a non-disclosure, to feel fairly short shrift from the court in terms of your approach of what is fair. They're more likely to be interested in then doing fairness to the victim.
Thank you. So, Ros, moving on now to Goddard Watts, and I know it was a very long-running case, but we're particularly interested in the latest instalment. Can you tell us about the facts of the case and how the court approached the rehearing in it?
Yes, it is somewhat of a household name to us matrimonial practitioners, having spanned a decade and still ongoing. All of the justices, Moore, Roberts, Moylan, Holman, Cohen, and three Lady Justices of Appeal have now published judgments on the litigation, so it's pretty extensive, but I'll do my best to summarise the history of the case as quickly as I can.
Thank you.
Mr. and Mrs. Goddard Watts, who I'm going to refer to intermittently as wife and husband because I get sidetracked and do that from time to time, so forgive me, compromised their financial claims against each other by consent in 2010. So there was a consent order then. Wife later discovered husband's interest in a number of undisclosed family trusts and applied to set aside the 2010 order in 2014. She succeeded in her application in 2015, and the first set aside judgment was given by Mr. Justice Moore and is reported as KG and LG, appeal out of time material non-disclosure. A rehearing followed in 2015 before Mr. Justice Moylan, as he was then. He handed down his decision in 2016, and he applied what we now know to be, as Jenna has described, the Kingdon approach to applications for set aside, where you isolate the non-disclosure, in this case, the non-disclosure of the family trusts, and award the aggrieved party their fair share of that asset. Mr. Justice Moylan found wife to have a sharing claim over the matrimonial element of the trust, and that was that. Fast forward to 2019, and the matter comes back before Mr. Justice Holman for Mrs. Goddard Watt's second set aside application, her having discovered that husband might not have been honest to Mr. Justice Moylan about the true prospects of his business being sold for a considerable sum of money. Once more, wife succeeds in her application. This time, the judgment of Mr. Justice Moylan fell away, and Sir Jonathan Cohen was later charged with deciding the matter once more, this time in 2022. Sir Jonathan agreed with husband and Mr. Justice Moylan and applied the Kingdon approach. He isolated the fraud which had been identified, but he found that the wife couldn't justify a sharing claim in the inflated value of the business. So he gave Mrs. Goddard Watts a modest inflation to her needs claim. This left the wife with Mrs. Goddard Watts with about 7.4 million and the husband with 71.6 million. So a 91%, 9% division in husband's favour. And it was that decision which was appealed. Thankfully, quite rightly, we succeeded. And the decision, the Court of Appeal agreed that in denying Mrs. Goddard Watts the opportunity properly to re-argue her case afresh, as Lady Justice McCaw put it, in toto and in real time, Sir Jonathan unfairly restricted her claim. In terms of helpful guidance, I'd say the judgment is somewhat lacking. Peter Mitchell KC and I, and I'm sure Simon Webster KC too, we certainly felt that this was an opportunity missed by the Court of Appeal to offer guidance which seemed to have been envisaged by Lady Justice King in granting us permission to appeal. So it might be an opportunity taken by the trial judge at the rehearing. So Mrs. Goddard Watts will have another, and I hope final, opportunity to put her claim before the court, unrestrained by previous decisions and unrestrained by Kingdon isolation.
So, Ros, what did the court decide in respect of the applicability of the Kingdon approach in Goddard Watts Court of Appeal?
Well, in short, Tara, Kingdon still applies, but the Court of Appeal's decision that Sir Jonathan Cohen was wrong in Goddard Watts to apply Kingdon shows that in circumstances where the non-disclosure is so egregious or so far-reaching, then a court's likely to be required to consider the financial landscape anew. Kingdon's about proportionality. There'll be cases where the non-disclosure can fairly be remedied by the simple isolation of the issue and without disrupting the rest of the award. But we were certain that that wasn't fair in our case because responsibility for the delay lay solely at Mr. Goddard Watts' door. And that's why Peter Mitchell impressed upon the court with such force the danger of allowing a husband to benefit from his fraud.
And the Court of Appeal makes some comments about the maxim fraud unravels all. Does the case mark a shift away from the usual approach that fraud unravels all?
Well, Lady Justice Carr, in her short supplemental judgment, made it clear that it can't be right that fraud unravels all of the time. Sharland and Kingdon are examples of cases where the fraud hasn't unraveled everything, it's unraveled something. It's certainly not as attractive to say that fraud unravels some things sometimes, but that's probably true. And a case really has to be decided on individual facts, and sometimes the unravelment of all won't be necessary or proportionate.
Yes, I suppose to achieve a fair outcome, it's not always necessary that fraud does unravel more. If it's not going to make any material difference, it goes back to that materiality point, yeah. Doesn't it?
Yeah.
And what about whether it's considered conduct?
Well, the issue of conduct certainly played a more prominent role in the hearing than Peter, Simon or I had anticipated. During the hearing, Lady Justice Davis and Lady Justice Carr took an interest in the prospect of Mr. Goddard Watts' conduct amounting to conduct under Section 25(2)(g) of the MCA. And it was an aspect of the case that we perhaps unexpectedly argued on behalf of Mrs. Goddard Watts. Although Lady Justice McCaw said that the husband's conduct in this case was conduct for the purposes of Section 2G, in that it's the glass through which to address the unnecessary delay in achieving finality of the wife's claim. But it's yet to be seen what impact that aspect of the judgment will have to counter the husband's argument that his wealth is entirely post-separation and therefore shouldn't form part of Mrs. Goddard-Watt's sharing claim.
Do you think, Ros, that the, you know, the sheer length of these proceedings and the number of hearings there have been have added to the court's views on conduct in this particular case?
Potentially, but I also think there's an element of we adopt an approach that conduct won't be relevant, but when you have a different tribunal, perhaps, and they're looking at the statute, they might see it differently. That's my impression.
Okay. And so, Ros, Jenna, for any of our listeners who might be representing clients with a potential set-aside application, have you got any do's or don'ts or any helpful tips for them to think about?
For me, your warding off set-aside application starts before you even get there. And one of the things I'm always quite surprised about is how disclosure can come out within your original financial remedy proceedings. And I think we've got to be really careful as practitioners to make sure that any disclosure that we're making in financial remedy proceedings is made in open correspondence. It's easy not to notice when your disclosure might be made in your lengthy without prejudice proposals, for example. And whilst the without prejudice rule isn't going to apply in terms of the information you can rely on in set-aside, it certainly muddies the water when it comes to asserting non-disclosure if your disclosure hasn't been given in a very clear form or leaves room for ambiguity. So that's my first tip, really, is to start thinking about the potential for those applications even before you get there.
Yeah, I mean, to build on that, I'd say the first point I'd make is don't delay. The minute you you think that there has been non-disclosure, don't delay. But if you can't, Jenna's rightly identified the open point, but if you can't elicit the further information that you require by way of voluntary disclosure, having sent open correspondence, you could think about pre-action disclosure before launching into contentious litigation. And look at, I think, the best thing you can possibly do is to try and obtain as much information as you can voluntarily. Then, if not, consider pre-action disclosure applications. And also, always think about early settlement discussions. These cases go on for years, as we've seen, and the costs, the stress are very, you know, so think about mediation, think about arbitration, but of course you can't force someone to go down that route. But they would be the first tips I'd give.
And I think, Tara, it's also important for people who have been through financial remedy proceedings where the mantra of costs is we each bear our own costs as a usual position, is in set aside part 28 rules on costs don't apply. They are clean sheet cases. So the unsuccessful party is likely to face the cost, not only their own cost, but also a significant proportion of the other parties as well. So you really need to stop and think before you make these applications and need to consider carefully if it's a meritorious application before you launch in. And another thing to think about is making early open proposals for settlement. And that comes back to the very basics of being a family lawyer, of identifying your client's objectives with them early in and telling the other side what you want. And it might be that that results in an early settlement and also helps to protect your position in terms of costs moving forwards.
Well, Ros, Jenna, I think that's all we've got time for today. Can I just say a huge thank you to both of you for giving up your time and guiding us through set-aside applications. I've learned an awful lot. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us, Tara.